Welcome to Piercing the Veil on bbsradio.com with your hosts Jordan and Corey and new guests appearing weekly. During the show, Jordan and Corey will pierce the many veils of illusion to reveal the universal truths and tools for negotiation inherent to success in one's daily life, including but not limited to 1. Multidimensional wordsmithing, 2. Mastering and commanding negotiations, 3. Constructive trust and wealth preservation, and 4. Spirituality. Pierce the veil, and the truth will reveal itself.
All right. Good day, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today with you. Today is April 3rd, 2016, and I am broadcasting from Texas, east of Austin, at a Sherwood Forest Scarborough Fair. So, I'm doing what we can to be with you. Corey, I know you're still over there in Arizona. I think you're in Tucson, right?
I'm in a park at a friend's birthday in Tucson, Arizona.
That's a level 5 commitment. Listeners, yes, we love you very much.
Likewise.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed last week's show. We talked a little bit about the nature of the universe, some spiritual power techniques when you leave the body. Basically, the shit that you're supposed to be learning how to do while you're here, and not wasting your entire fucking life watching the TV or learning how to do something in a rigid fashion, and you know, like a college, something like that. Should definitely be learning spiritual and psychic abilities. They are there. Everyone has them. That's what we touched on last week. You can go to the archives if you want that. That's bbsradio.com/piercingtheveil. Corey, this week we promised our listeners a little bit about sustainable earth bag building, different types of intentional communities, building those from the scratch or from scratch from the ground up. And, you know, I sort of just want to start by talking about regular housing. You know, let's talk about what not to build and what everybody seems to have a problem with having to maintain constantly throughout their life. Whereas not only are they burdened with a mortgage, not only are you killed with a death pledge, mortgage death pledge, right?
Till death do us part.
Yeah, that's right. And you're carrying the physical burden of the house itself. It's like an anchor. It's like a weight, you know? So it's basically engineered to fail. The materials they're using, obviously we understand that with the codes and the building restrictions and things like this that they've built up, you have to use certain materials in certain places at certain levels and from different, you know, at certain distances from other types of materials. And this one's flammable and this one's not. You got to cover it with a non-flammable thing that only one company makes or two company makes and manufactures. You know what I'm talking about? So it's just another domain for which the money fiat currency can just build and build and build and inflate and inflate and inflate and inflate. So again, like we talked last week, they can show a gross national product to the international powers to get more funding because the Federal Reserve is not running the show anymore and have not been for a long time as far as the fiat currency is concerned. So everything's pretty much obsolete physically. Does that make sense, Corey? The building materials we're using are completely fucking stupid and obsolete. But the purpose of having to use them isn't, because that's what's being used to prop up the system in just one tiny domain of life. You understand?
Right.
Seen? They're doing a lot of building out there. What have you seen lately? I see those, you know, developments going up, and it makes me sad. It hurts my heart.
Well, I mean, I'm out here in Arizona. I'm out here in the desert. People have been building out here for, I don't know, a couple thousand years probably. And typically they use adobe, you know, some kind of mud hut with some kind of, you know, some kind of plant material roof. And, you know, like many other places on the planet where there's not a lot of materials around and not a lot of money, you just... You know,
you're talking about in your local area in the desert where people are actually getting into what we're going to be talking about. But have you noticed like the huge developments at all? Like in Tucson,
there
about a year ago.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of development going on. I happen to have a background as a builder. I've studied architecture. I've had construction companies in New York City. You know, new buildings, mostly renovations. You know, I've done some renovation work out here. And I had a friend of mine who called me the builder who hates buildings, which I couldn't disagree. I couldn't disagree with, because, you know, for instance, out here, they have, and I'm looking at one right now. It's a building that's stick built, basically, which means wood studs, like wood frame and, you know, fir, Douglas fir. And then it's stuccoed on the outside to look like an adobe building. Very common building type out here. And, you know, it even has vigas, you know, it looks like it's got roof beams sticking out the side.
Why the hell would you just build with adobe?
Right. That's my point. I mean, Douglas fir comes from fucking, you know, Canada.
Canada. Oh, my
okay,
gosh.
So, you know, there's all of these. And as you say, the building codes are pretty much uniform across the country, and it's becoming more international. And I'm not necessarily against that, because people are, you know, sometimes people engage in things that are over their
Corey,
head.
Corey, I agree. They may do themselves harm
and someone else harm.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's a lot of shady builders, just like any other realm. But I wanted to touch on this real quick because of what you just said, how you are sort of in alignment with there should be some sort of regulations. In the old days, and this goes back like to the origins of the Masons, the original antediluvian stone builders, you know what I mean? The dudes that were using high technology, sound levitation to lift gigantic stones, and using extreme magnetic resonance, you know, free energy machines to heat up the stone to such a point where they could just boil it, and they just toss it in these pits and just boil it and then melt it like into a liquid. And now you know why the pyramids and these other, you know, megalithic structures have no spaces or cracks in between the stones. They're literally formed and melted into place. Well, the original builders back then, the work that they were doing, if they were going to make a public place, if anyone besides themselves or the family was going to stand under that building or that arch or whatever it was, the roof, if you will, because that was a typical occurrence, a roof collapsing, not the walls. If they were going to stand under it, they were standing by their work. And what I mean by that is the law was that when you built an arch or you built a public house or something, they made the fucking builder. They made him sleep in that thing or under it for at least 4 days to make sure it wouldn't crack. And if it did, well, guess what? Guess who wouldn't be doing any more shoddy work in that area? You understand?
That's personal responsibility right there.
That's right. So who was motivated to never, ever do shoddy work? The builder.
The builders.
And that was the origin of the stonemasons. They got so into it, and they had all these different types of course, there's probably more origin stories, but I'm talking about way, when I say masons, I mean stone builders, and they're just sort of like a little offshoot of what this culture really was and existed way back before. You understand?
Right.
So those guys, they were using high-level technology, I believe, personally. But I also believe that they were only doing that because they knew the ins and outs of what they were really doing. You understand? Like, they knew how to properly set things in place. And, you know, if anybody did do it by hand or tried to replicate what these guys were doing, they were probably behind some of the laws for the general protection or beneficial interest of the public.
Right.
Say, hey, these guys are going to try to do what we do without the knowledge we have of why we're doing it. Well, this rock actually has a magnetic field that collects and sticks to this rock. And so when you blend them together and mix them into a paste, they actually form a structural bond, sort of like putting rebar through concrete. You understand? So like they probably knew these types of things and other people didn't. So when they tried to replicate the, you know, structures, they would fail. And so then you have problems with people dying en masse, and then you have the law where the builder has to stay underneath. You understand? So that's kind of about using tools you're not ready for. That's what that speaks to as far as I'm concerned.
Right. And also, too, you look at the temple builders, like Giza Pyramid. There's so much mathematics in that thing.
Yes.
First of all, we don't...
High level.
First of all, we're only speculating about what that was for in the first place. Some say energy generators and other kinds of things or portals, whatever. But, yeah, I mean, anyone who's looked into it a little bit, it's still the current assessment that most of those stones, at least the larger stones, not the surface stones, were so big that we don't have modern day technology to be able to move them physically.
That's right. So, and I don't know what you would call a true, maybe a level or true, true line where, you know, two spaces, like there's no crack in between. There's literally no space. I know they have little calipers or certain types of tools to measure cracks in between.
Yeah. It's like, there's a lot of speculation around that. Maybe, you know, I've heard
they melted them.
I've heard all kinds of things from melting to laser cutting. I saw one thing recently where they were showing stones that looked like they were saw cut, but with some kind of super, you know, high-tech advanced, you know, it's got to be, right? I mean, they cut stones now.
Oh, you're talking about Glenn Hancock and the stone and the toolmaker's marks. He could see the tool marks.
Maybe. But even still, even with that, that would be like the lowest level technology.
That's right.
That has been presented, aside from a bunch of guys dragging a bunch of stones around, which clearly wasn't the case.
That's right.
But the way to be able to cut these things with such a level of precision. And then to move them and to fit them into place and then to have planned the whole thing in advance. And it's just beyond comprehension. Suffice to say.
So based on what you can comprehend and your assessment, would you say those types of structures were engineered to last or engineered to fail?
Well, 10,000+ years at least.
Yeah, exactly. So it is possible. Yeah. It is so possible. And you know, the let's talk about for a second, Corey, the harvesting methods. I want to hear your take on this because as a person who's acquiring mass amounts of lumber on a regular basis and other types of traditional building materials, shall we say, I want to know, like, how is this being done? Is it just raise the whole fucking forest to the floor like everybody thinks? Or is that the general practice? Or is it a few guys sort of stepping outside the lines, you know, like into the offskirts trying to make more money by doing these things? Are there any regulations in place? And how are they enforced, you know, at all, if any, as far as, you know, the sustainable harvesting of materials?
As far as I know, you know, you'll hear a lot of people complain about government regulation on commerce, right? And particularly on raw materials and things like that, right? I'm sure I'll give you an example. I had a business partner who was from Guyana, which is like, I think, just below Venezuela and South America on the Atlantic side. And his wife's family, since the 20s, had a mill, a wood mill, and they had a land concession, which was basically a land grant by the government for them to harvest lumber. So they'd go upstream to their grant. They cut down trees. They would chainsaw them into rough lumber, or they would float them down a river to their mill, and then mill them up, and then typically, that stuff was mostly used domestically. And we were trying, we ended up importing some hardwoods and stuff into the city to use on some jobs. But these guys, no one had to tell them how to properly harvest. Without
to pick
doing
from
a
here
lot
and
damage.
Pick from there. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You leave the
old
leave
growth
the,
versus new growth.
Right. You leave the super old growth trees, right? The old. You leave the oldest trees because they're the source. They're an ecosystem unto themselves.
Agreed.
And what you do is you kind of go through and you harvest, you know, some younger trees or some mid-age trees. And what that does, you know, you space it out in a way. And what that does is when you remove one of the middle growth trees out, you have a clearing in the forest. Okay, so that then the younger growth trees get sunlight and they fill in the void. You know, and these guys, you know, back in the 20s, they knew about that shit. Now, on the flip side, when we came down the river, we saw a whole stretch of river and, you know, a few miles deep that had been clear cut by the Chinese. They came in, cut everything down, put them on barges, and send them over to China to be milled. There's a lot of places now where they're kind of getting up on that, where at least they're requiring foreign entities who are obtaining the raw material to at least have to process them locally, so that, you know, there's some kind of there's a greater
incentive
benefit.
Yeah. Oh, and, my God. Well, yeah, what benefit is...
And the thing is there's another place, Curaçao. There's a little island. There's the ABC Island, Bonaire, Antigua, and Curaçao. And Curaçao...
Yeah, I was a bartender for 10 years, so those oranges and the liqueurs and everything, I'm familiar.
So Curaçao used to be... all those islands in the tropics, a lot of mahogany, right? A lot of various indigenous types of hardwood species, tropical species. But Curaçao, as far as I know, was covered with mahogany. And when I went there, it was the desert. It was a desert island. There was nothing, you know, there was nothing left there. So the problem with clear cutting anywhere is that you completely, you know, it's happening in the Amazon for various reasons, less so for lumber than for cattle grazing and agriculture. They're clearing out the jungle for cattle and for agriculture, and probably in certain places for housing for human beings to occupy.
So they can destroy the land even further once again.
Right. Now, here in the States, I'm sure it's more regulated, but, if you grease the right palm, there's always a way to get out of the rules
right.
and regulations. So, you know, I mean, I
it's,
know...
It sounds like a variety. It sounds like you've got... So it is sort of appearing to be balanced, but honestly, I mean, with the clear cutting, there's no way it could ever remain in balance because they're cutting everything, and you guys are doing your little picking here and there, so there's always going to be this... Gobbling up. It almost, when you talked about it, almost reminded me, you know, if anybody's seen this, Fern Gully. It reminded me of Fern Gully, that movie. You know what I'm talking about?
It.
With that, delicious. You know, you like the little entity thing that came out of that tree and is just mowing down everything. They're just cutting down the entire forest. Look up Fern Gully. Ferngully. Watch that movie.
Okay.
You'll get an idea of what we're talking about when we say clear cutting. And
clear cutting is you destroy everything. There's nothing left. You have an ecosystem and environment that's been there for thousands and it's not millions of years, and then you just take away everything and it's nothing. There's nothing left. It's just a dust bowl. And then you get soil erosion, and you get all these other kinds of problems.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you remember this, okay? You remember the episode we did on psychedelics?
Mm-hmm.
And mushrooms, mycelium. Okay. Mushrooms are covering every single continent. They're all underneath the ground, and they're responsible for breaking down the rocks and the minerals, the mycelium,
and,
if I'm saying.
And cellulose.
That's right.
Bacteria,
well, they bond. Everything, including the human body and all trees, all plants, everything, have some sort of mycelium DNA that's just ingrained in it from the roots in the soil. It wraps around the roots, it gets into it, and it becomes part of the DNA chain, and it's a partnership, right? So when you're destroying everything on top, you're also destroying everything on the bottom, which is why you're getting these deserts you're talking about. So
there's no soil.
Corey, I want to hear some more about that when we come back. And I know that you said there's a lot of regular adobe going out there in Arizona and other parts of the Southwest. I do believe there's some other techniques that some really interesting people are using.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about some of those. And we'll go to commercial break when we get back. Corey, I'd like you to finish your point on a couple of other things. And we'll see you when we get back.
Having trouble with harassing collection agencies? Creditors breathing down your neck? Feeling like you're drowning in debt? The Guild of Tactical Wordsmiths is here to help you now. GTAC is an ecclesiastical guild association of aggressive debt assassins who can eliminate your debts, free negative marks from your credit report, and get you compensated for unfair collection practices or emotional damages. They have a proven track record of success and sustainable results, which will have creditors and debt collectors shaking in their boots. This is not your typical credit repair or verification. GTAC uses proven techniques and negotiation tactics to completely eliminate your debt or conflict, remove negative marks from your credit reports, and in most cases, GTAC will retrieve compensation for you. Call for your free 15-minute consultation today at 214-290-3053.
All right, welcome back, everyone. If you just joined us, today we were talking a little bit about the unsustainability of regular housing, the unsustainable methods that are used sometimes with clear cutting for building materials, that's lumber and so on and so forth. Corey was speaking a little bit into those types of things based on his experience in business as a builder. And we're also going to be discussing a little bit of Adobe and Super Adobe and Hyper Adobe and these different types of natural building methods that are a sustainable alternative to what we've just described and we're talking about. So Corey, if you could just please finish your point. I'm sorry we had to go to commercial there for a second. What was your point that you were talking about specifically with the whole housing scheme or the game? If you could just wrap it up, what was your experience on a whole?
Well, I remember when I was a builder being appalled by the amount of waste. You know, like in New York City, like I said, we weren't doing a lot of new buildings, but lots of renovations of apartments. And it was mostly metal studs and things like that. But just the amount of waste, just the amount of stuff that went into landfill or was, and some of it was recycled, you know, but it just, I don't know, a lot of it just doesn't make sense to me. Like I'm also an artist and a sculptor, and a lot of the stuff that I do is using discarded materials. So I use discarded materials in my sculpture. Lots of metal stuff. There's all kinds of cool metal bits and things that you find out in the desert. And likewise for my furniture and for my artwork. So it's kind of that as a builder, seeing how much waste that we've created, I just kind of, aside from the aesthetics of beautifully rusted things that you could find out that have been exposed to the environment for a long period of time, it's just a theme for me I would love to do a project where, I mean, I could build a house with, I could go to landfills and pick stuff up off street corners and, you know, use raw materials lying around in the desert. I could build a house, you know, for the cost that it takes me mostly to haul shit around. There's that much stuff, useful material, lying around that's being thrown out with a little bit of creativity and imagination and some understanding of building sciences. There's no reason to spend, you know, the typical minimum, like $140, $150 a square foot to build a shelter. Another thing is, and it's a big deal out in the desert, a lot of the cost in operating a typical house or any kind of structure, a commercial structure or a residential structure, is in heating and cooling. Right, so you're gonna, if you get an HVAC unit, you know, a forced air system or something, you're gonna be spending a lot of money on that technology, and also through the lifetime of the building, you're gonna have, that's where most of your energy costs are gonna come from, particularly out here in the desert. You get blazing hot during the daytime for, you know, a good portion of the year, and then during the winter, you know, typically it gets at or near freezing, or, you know, below 45, somewhere between 25 and 45 typically. So at nighttime, you got to heat the place. So it's another aspect that's really critical out here, is to be able to use the environment. the use of thermal massing, right? In the wintertime, when the sun is lower in the sky, you want to capture that sunlight inside the building, right? Let the sunlight come in and heat up some kind of masonry or thermal mass, typically the floor or something, inside the building. And then at nighttime, that's going to be radiating inside the structure. You know, so adobe walls are good for that. Thick adobe, thick masonry walls. It collects the sun, the solar radiation during the day, and it releases some of it into the building at nighttime. You know, how you orient the building towards the sun, right? You want to be able to get that winter sunlight coming in on the south, and you want to be able to block off the summer sunlight from blasting you, you know, right, during the day, and typically in the late afternoon, right? There's also, so wind,
these are things
how air flows through the building, these kinds of things. And I take it for granted because I've studied it and I have an interest in it, I guess. But for the most part, throughout the country and throughout the world, from what I can see, it's you build some kind of a box. You maybe put as much insulation in it. You put some double, you know, some insulated windows. And then you stick a machine on top that heats and cools it when you need. And it's like a super, you know, it's kind of a super reduced, simplified process that doesn't take into consideration tens of thousands of years of how people went about building things just based on allowing or accommodating for the environment that they live in.
Well, it sure produces a lot of expense now, don't it?
It does, and, you know, that's what you need in a debt-based society.
That's right, exactly. Thank you for touching on that, yes. So what I'm hearing is that you had to see all of this in front of your face in order to gain a greater appreciation for what your interests already were as far as earthbag building, adobe, and some of these things that people and cultures have been doing, you know, just instinctively for,
right,
you know, let's say it, hundreds of thousands of years, okay?
Right.
And the adobe, I mean, just for our listeners, if nobody's heard of adobe, I believe, can be mixed a number of different ways. Typically, you will use some sort of clay, some water, some sort of straw, a little bit of perhaps newspaper or some other paper material, something like that, some of the plant materials that's sort of been broken and bruised and, you know, whipped around and sort of meshed together, and then you can just sort of put it in there and you stomp around in it and you step on it with your feet over and over and over and over. You can put little tiny pebbles in there, all sorts of things to reinforce it. And while it's still pliable, then you build with it. Typically, you know, masonry bricks are used for certain types of rocket stoves, which are adobe, you know, covered stoves. And then the buildings, you know, you might have some sort of wood structure or some sort of natural timber structure and go around it with adobe. Or you can just go adobe itself. And people have been doing this successfully. There's still structures in, you know, southwest Arizona, New Mexico, and all these places. And, you know, using the straw and the clay, it's just something about the earth being around you, surrounding you. No longer are you standing on Mother Earth, but it's surrounding you and a part of your home, right?
Right.
I think that's why people have, number one, shit, we need a shelter. It's cold outside. Number two, we don't have a fucking technology, you know, level to know what the hell a AC or a heating system is. So we're going to make it passive, right?
Right.
So all these things were learned the hard way. But then number three, now we're cocooned. We're one and connected with our natural environment. You understand? So, and these techniques have been sort of refined. They have been refined over the years. And you've got people using stuff like Super Adobe, which is typically, it's the same sort of mixture. And it has 10% Portland cement. And it uses polyvinyl bags, which are these white bags for storage. They usually come in rolls. And they're anywhere from 18 to 24 inches, depending on the purpose that you're going to be using them. And once you fill them, you're going to tamp them down. And now you can build with these little bags or lines or rows that you intersect with each other and reinforce with barbed wire. Super Adobe, I think Nadir, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce the last name, but it's Cal Earth Tech, Technical Institute.
Oh, yeah.
That's the full name. You know what I'm talking about? It's in California.
Yeah, yeah.
Nadir Kadali or something like that, he perfected a super Adobe technique. And that's, again, that's using the polyvinyl bags. And they make all these little badass domes. You can look this up on YouTube or whatever means you have available to you wherever you're at in the world. And they're just, they're so beautiful. And then you just stucco over them, and now you've got a house or a mansion, you know,
right?
Depending on how much you want to go.
Yeah, and the you've cool got thing this is perfect about
little thing.
Yeah, the cool thing about that technology with the long bags, you know, that they kind of coil.
The rolls.
Like an igloo, it's like an igloo almost, but you have these long. I mean, basically, it's like a coil pot. It's the same technology that other people in this part of the world use to make pottery.
If anyone's ever potted before and has picked up a roll, a snake-like roll of clay, and laid it in a circle and then put more on there and intersected them and made them tinier or bigger or, you know, however you went, then you know exactly what Corey's talking about, and that's exactly how they do these super Adobe things. It's just the most badass thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe that. Yeah, I think what they do is that the bags are permeable, so they, I think they might wet them down, right? They have the dry material in the bags, and then they wet them down.
I believe the material's wet. They wet the material to a certain consistency, yes.
And then fill the bags. But then also, they'll build a fire inside. So they're like firing, you know, they take a coil pot, turn it upside down, and build a fire in it, and fire the clay pot. So basically, you're living in a giant coil clay pot, you know, dome structure. Yeah,
tempered.
It's been tempered with heat. And then there's raw adobe bricks. There's sun-dried adobe bricks. There's burnt, different kinds of burnt and tempered adobe bricks. There's all kinds of ways going about it. There's rammed earth. That's another one. It's kind of expensive. Where you're just taking the same tires. Thing. You're basically taking local material. You have to build forms to make your walls. But instead of pouring concrete in your forms, you're tamping down, you know, layers of local dirt. And whatever binders, like you mentioned, clay, typically adobe has clay. It's found mostly in kind of riverbed areas, I think. With that high clay content, but something that binds, right? And you mentioned the plant material, that's like kind of reinforcement. And like you were saying, there's different types of adobe. If you're adding Portland cement, you can add other things to them. How much strength do you need, right? A wall, if it's just in compression vertically, doesn't need to have a lot of strength necessarily. But if you have other types of shapes that aren't perfectly, you know, dealing with compression vertically, you know, then you might have to add some other kind of something to your admixture or what have you. You know, there's, I've heard of a thing called soilcrete, which is, it's basically the same thing.
Yes.
You take the dirt and the aggregate, the, you know, small stones and the dirt and the soil that's around you, depending on, you know, where you're at. And then you'll mix that with some kind of Portland cement or something. So,
and then put it in the polyvinyl bags or those rolls that you're talking about. And there's also another technique, Corey. It's called Hyper Adobe. And they're still using the poly bags like the Super Adobe for their foundational levels, their bases, their structural nodes, their load-bearing walls for strength. But then they use these less expensive, more readily available and plentiful Rochelle bags. Sort of, if you've ever seen potatoes or onions in a large colored netting bag, those are polyvinyl. They've just been netted into strings. Right. They're super, super strong, but lightweight. So you can build these huge, huge, you know, things with polyvinyl for the different floors and the walls in certain areas, and then the rest of it is using the Rochelle bags. You know, and in almost all cases, if you build these structures well and you're following, you know, common sense, obviously, and other things, they're bulletproof, floodproof, earthquake, tornado, fireproof,
You know, especially right. if you're partially or fully underground in some case.
Right.
And, you know, like you said, you touched on this, Corey, easily built with local available free recycled, donated, you know, bartered materials, whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
And people might be asking, well, you know, this sounds like a lot. You guys are douchebags. Well, why are you telling me to do all this stuff? Why don't I just live in my house and be, you know, happy? You're dumb. Well, it sounds like a lot, but these things can be done by two people. You can build your own damn house in less than 3 months with two people who are dedicated and committed and have a few simple tools like a bucket, a shovel, the bags, maybe a ladder, and a few other simple things, right?
Uh-huh.
Some gloves and some barbed wire. Bam, you got yourself a badass house that can be as big as you want, can have as many levels as you want, can be custom built so you're not living in a square with no energy flow when you're sitting there trying to... You're sitting there trying to feng shui your house, but the house itself is unfeng shui. You're playing a losing game there, house moms. Okay? So you just got to understand. The house itself, the container itself is important. It's very easy to build. It's extremely cheap if you do it right. And it's extremely strong. Plus, for everybody who's a stickler about codes, these things, because of the nature of them being proofed, I just went through the list earlier, they actually meet all international building codes and surpass and exceed them. There's a certain thing you might be familiar with this as a builder, Corey. There's a certain test that certain or local counties have, or even states. It's where they put a mock or a model scale of the house onto a earthquake machine, which is just a big plate that vibrates a lot and rocks around.
Right.
Understand? And they see how much force it's going to take to knock that down. Like total failure. I'm not talking about shingles falling off. We're talking about like the entire thing collapsing.
Right.
You understand? They put a model of these sustainable buildings on there. It broke the machine. They had to go all the way up, turn the dial all the way up, and it broke. It burned out. Of course, they just replaced the fuses and stuff. It was still ready. But they couldn't break it. They couldn't break the model.
Right.
It's structurally sound.
Right.
Okay.
And
there you go, listeners. It's easy to do. Yeah.
And there is so much information online, and that's another thing that's another thing which I think is really great about this time. Barring information overload, if you're discerning anything that you want to find out about, you can find out about. You know, if you want to build your own house, you've never touched a fucking saw before. If you're committed, and you can do the research and maybe take on some advisors or something. There's nothing, you know, it's building is not that difficult. Most of it is common sense, and there's so much information out there, particularly even with regards to these more traditional, I was going to say newer technologies, but maybe they're returning to the more traditional technologies. So much information
that's
out
right
there. So it's totally worth it.
It's super easy, Corey, exactly like you're saying. And it's super easy to look up how to integrate systems. People might be asking, well, where am I going to take a dump? You know, where's the stuff coming out of my body need to go? You know, how am I going to have plumbing if you don't do it? There's plenty of options. Composting toilets don't have to be stinky and nasty. You don't need to carry buckets around. You can do all sorts of different things that are permanent solutions that then turn everything into usable soil. No, we're not talking Chinese fertilizer, human waste, excrement that's not processed. We're talking about the nature process of decomposition to the fullest. Biochar, all these different types of things that can accelerate the process. So all of these concerns or comfort concerns can not only be taken care of in these types of houses, but made specifically for that. You know what I mean? So you can actually have passive healing, but you can also have solar panel heating.
Right.
I said healing, but you know, passive healing, that's what it's doing to you. But passive heating and solar heating, active. You can have solar hydrogen.
Right.
You can integrate, you know, hybrid capacitor and battery bank systems, power systems for capturing and storing your energy. There's ways to screen hydrogen made from the sun energy into its perfect pure form so it's not explosive and store it in propane tanks. Run it through electrolyzer again. Voila, you've got electricity and oxygen and molecular water pure.
Right. And then you have the Stanley Meyer you know, extract hydrogen from water through electrolysis, and boom, you have a, you know, you have a, you have a burnable gas that's 10 times more efficient than gasoline or some other kind of petrol, you know, heating oil or something like that. So
see, it's funny. It's because the petrol and the ore and the stuff they're using for fuel is coated hydrogen. It's bonded hydrogen. They're using more energy to break the bonds of the hydrogen from the carbons, the hydrocarbons, and all these other things. And it's so fucking inefficient. Instead of just going to the water and going, oh, there's some hydrogen right there, bloop, and separating it. And what it's funny you touch on Stanley Myers, Corey, because many people mistake his work for electrolysis, which is not the case. He was using doped electrodes. He made electrets. An electret is like a magnet. It produces a constant field. But he made electrets with high frequency voltage. He basically charged them like you would with sound. You charge like one of those healing bracelets, you know, with sound to a frequency. He did that with the water by using an electret, which is basically an anode and a cathode coated in a certain substance and then hit with a frequency. You understand? So he was actually using,
It was the extra frequency that made his stuff particularly interesting because it ended up defying what second law of thermodynamics, where he was getting more energy out of the system than he was putting in, and the people still debate that stuff today. But I've seen clearly enough evidence that
the field they might have to rewrite that law. Yeah, he was using magnets to help, and the field was there. And what he's also doing with his voltage intensifier circuit, or the VIC, as he called it, he was actually building transformers that were sitting in the water, and they would induce the local vacuum to produce a response. And that response was an influx of energy, so it spiked the voltage of the 12-volt array he was already using. You understand? And then he put it through a frequency modulation to disassociate or separate the water, and then was using the electrets to produce a constant field in there to work in conjunction with the magnetic voltage intensifier. And so what he was doing is basically amplifying. And now when people try to run their cars just on water today, they're like, well, we don't have enough gas production. And so they try to raise the amps by themselves, and it drops the voltage. Whereas he was pulling in a huge amount of voltage, restructuring it, and then sending it through to stuff that would carry it easily. And because of the resonant signal that was going through the water to the charge that was there, it was disassociating the hydrogen at a rapid rate. Now get this. This guy was driving around the country on the same 5 fucking gallons of water for 3+ years. He was sending his exhaust back through a clear tube, and the photon and tachyon energy from the sun was hitting that water. It went back into his tank, and he used it again.
Voila. He collected. So there was water vapor, and oxygen was the exhaust.
Produced as a result. That's right.
Right, so he was collecting the water vapor, recycling. Yeah, apparently he said he could drive like 400 miles on a cup. Of water.
That was his first buggy. He actually upgraded it. So at the upgraded version, when he was at the end of his life, before he was poisoned and killed for this, the upgraded version was he was able to run the water back through a tube. The light would hit it. It would charge it again, and he could fuel his car again.
Right. Yeah, and of course, you know, those kinds of things can be used, you know, in a house. And also, too, as I was mentioning, you know, a big energy cost is heating and cooling. So if you're taking your building design, if you're taking passive solar, right, if you're taking the environment into account and you're using the environment maximally, then you're going to be lowering your need for any additional energy consumption in heating and cooling. So that would end up reducing. You know, you could cut your typical solar array in half or down to 25%.
You need a steady 12 volts at a good amperage, and you can also mix in some wind energy, and then you store the hydrogen in propane tanks or a large propane tank after it's been screened. You split off the oxygen line. Now you've got medical grade oxygen for whatever you want to use, perhaps oxyacetylene torches, right? And then you've got the pure hydrogen coming out again. You mix it with a line, a split-off line from the oxygen, recombine it. Now you've got pure molecular water source from the hydrogen that you're burning from whatever nasty water source that you had. And then once
you've got water purification,
that water
to
storage, and then once you've stored it, then you can structure it as it comes out, like they're doing in Australia for commercial farming, and they're growing, you know, magnetically structured resonance water vegetables. So they have strawberries, you know, and fruits as well. They have strawberries that are as big as your fist or bigger. And so there's nothing stopping you from integrating all these systems, and it's especially well accepted when you're using earth bags and other types of sustainable methods. It's just made for it. And then if you want to take it a step further, listeners, and you can just, you know, Corey, you know something about this. You can just embed crystals in certain places or under your house or in the walls or make, you know, make a entire bottle brick structure full of, you know, these different types of glass bottles with a certain color so you can stand in front of it. When the sun hits it, it heals you with the color. You know what I'm talking about? The color healing. Maybe build sacred geometry. All of these are possible when you're in control of what the container is that you're choosing to spend your life in. And it's all done without obligating yourself to a death contract, a mortgage for an entire lifetime for most people. And then on top, oh, well, that mortgage wasn't enough. We need more debt. Let's do a reverse mortgage or a second mortgage, yada, yada, yada. You know, we need more shit that ties us down. So moving into this lifestyle is an entire paradigm shift about how you look at everything, including waste and waste in your own personal life. And you talked about waste earlier, Corey. That's a real big thing. You know, there's no reason why you can't take the water that's coming out of your shower and put a thermocouple device. It's very easy to make, which means it converts heat to electricity. And now the hot water that comes out of your shower goes down the drain is powering, I don't know, an alarm system or a low DC power, you know, radio or something that you have going on in your house. And then also taking that water, if you're using organic soaps and shower stuff, taking the water and putting it through a gray water recycle system.
And then watering your plants and your garden.
Exactly. There's all sorts of stuff like, you know, you can burn, I cannot take credit for this. I looked this up on YouTube. And you can burn certain types of animal wastes and feathers and different types of things for a certain time period at a temperature, and it creates these oxides and these little doping agents you can put on your solar panels and then encase the solar panels and then run carbon dioxide from your greenhouse into it, and it produces methyl, right? Methyl alcohol and ethanol, which you can both use to power engines, generators, small engines, all these types of things. So this whole recycle system is possible. It's very easily done. You just need to make the commitment to shift to the lifestyle.
Right. I'm gonna do a project like that. I'm gonna do a semi-public project, which is build a house out of all recycled materials. You know, and the hardest thing would be, the hardest thing would be like, okay, windows or something like that. But I tell you, there's so much stuff being pulled out of older houses, for example, and just being tossed. And a little bit of look, the way things are going, people, in order to survive, are going to have to get off of the credit, easy credit, mortgage yourself for life, you know, gravy train, if you will, that we've been on. It's almost like the system is being engineered in such a way where it's designed to implode someday, and that the people who are particularly clever and the people who are particularly paying attention and have a long memory and understand history and a certain level of common sense and so forth, and who know how to, you know, reuse things and galvanize themselves in productive communities and things like that. The way that things seem to be going, that's going to be the only way that we can survive, right? Let alone food.
Yeah, it's the only answer that I'm aware of. A sustainable answer. Anything else is just made to fail.
Yeah, let alone food. I mean, there's no reason for your food to come 2,500 miles to get to you. First of all, it's going to have to be picked early. It's going to have to be sprayed so it doesn't fucking rot. And you're burning up hydrocarbons and you know, to get it 2,500 miles to you. Grow a fucking tomato in your, you know, make a little greenhouse and grow your own tomatoes. In fucking
That's right.
Canada. In Canada. You know, or up near the Arctic Circle or whatever. You know, if you want tomatoes.
It's possible, Corey. It is possible. You got to commit to it, and, you know, you might make yourself a target. Or you might be in a certain energy state because it's so new to you that you attract yourself as a target. You attract these lessons in your life. And if you're not ready with the tactical wordsmithing or the preemptive solutions that we've given most people, like a fence, a gate, and a notice, you're going to have some problems in most places. You understand?
Yeah.
So
talk to me.
Still be like, yeah, go ahead.
No, talk to me right quick because I know we're running out of time. We talked about buildings. We talked about the structures and sustainability and so forth. Touch on, if you would, what we were talking about earlier about interfacing with the local authority. In terms,
That's right.
right? Because there's certain rules and regulations as far as municipal, as far as building codes and, you know, inspections and permits and things like that. How would you, yep. for people who are trying to do this on their own, how would you suggest the interface with the municipal authorities?
Yeah, and there's a number of different ways to do that. Little intricacies involved. That's where I was going next. I really appreciate that we're on the same page all the time. You got to choose your location wisely, first of all. You're going to mitigate your risk by choosing a location that's just completely devoid of any type of restrictions. You might have some sort of minimum square footage thing that you have to deal with, but other than that, it's not going to be an issue. So the first step, obviously, choose the location wisely. Then you're going to mitigate your risk. So if you're building, you need to try to negotiate with these people before you start building. Don't just start building right off the bat and say, I'm this blah, 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 I've got the claim to the land and all that crap. You're just going to start a war. You understand? So what you need to do is negotiate, build a partnership with the local community. Show them that you intend to provide some sort of value to the local area and that they have access to the property on at least one day. Does that make sense? So, hey, public city officials, city commerce, chamber people, you know, I intend on doing this sustainable community. I'm going to do this, this, and that. This is how I'm going to do it. Everything I'm building is going to meet international building codes. And it also either meets or exceeds what you guys are asking for. So there's no need for me to even ask for a permit. I'm just going to go get it certified by an international builder certifier or, you know, some sort of analyst. And he can come in and say, yeah, this thing's good job. It's structurally sound. It's not going to fall on somebody's head and kill them. You understand? And he can write up a little report. You can send that to them along with some sort of presentment. I don't know, Corey, we talked about this earlier. Why not create a trust? Set up a trust with these public official people and say, hey, look, here's the tangible res. Here's some silver, some sort of value that you guys can use as a trustee for the benefit of everybody around me. The beneficiaries are anyone who lives within this city zone, whether that's you offset your costs for a new road that you were planning to use taxpayer funds for, whether that's you do this or that, you know, any of these options, if it benefits them, they have free will to do it with a tangible res. Tangible meaning physical. You gave them money. With the intangible res, that could be any type of agreements, documentations, operating rules, principles, procedures, any licenses or sort of like mental things that you create or ideas, I guess that would be intellectual properties, the structure of the community, all these things are intangible res. So that if these officials accept your money and they keep the trust indenture, they're agreeing to act in a public trustee capacity if they ever interact with you, if they ever show up at your property, if any of their agents ever show up at your property, if somebody comes to the community, do you understand? If they even, you know, if they even so much as look at the property or drive by it or fly over it or dig under
if they even think of you.
If they even think of you, they're active in capacity as a public trustee. Now, they're bound to duties that they can't escape. If they do fail in their duties, you have the right to take them to federal court and sue the ever-living shit out of them. and you will win. And I'm talking municipal judges, police chiefs, any person in that town you need to be negotiating with. If they're typically claiming an immunity because of their public office, you're letting them know if you're acting in any way in my public trust office, you're completely devoid of any other, you're completely separate. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You still hold your immunities in a different capacity, but you're devoid of them in this capacity and you're liable. So you can make things happen, and you won't necessarily need to go to court.
Right. And you'll be establishing the nature of the parties in a trust relationship before you run into problems.
Right. That's right. And the bottom line is preemptive, guys. Choose a location wisely. Do some research. Call the local city people. Call them. It could be Joe and Jane Billy, you know, from the outskirts of town that run that whole place because they've got the most land or something. And they're on the Chamber of Commerce, and they call the shots unofficially, even though officially they can only vote. You understand? But it's a small town, so everybody listens to them. No matter what, you know, what anybody else says, you need to watch out for that, or make friends with that person and join the team.
And there's location. Also, you know, their location. And, you know, I would think that it would be better. I don't know. I mean, if you're in a municipality, if you're in a small city, a big city, a small town, if you're completely rural, I would tend to think that, you know, being completely rural, you'd have a little more leeway.
Okay.
With the type of building that you
do. Actually have to wrap it up real quick. I apologize. So we talked a lot about how not to do it, how to do it, what to use, why you should use it. We're actually going to go into another show next week about this. I'm going to have a guest on. His name is Frank Bacon. And we will delve a little bit more into the intellectual, the community aspect, how to run a community, how to use alternative currencies, how to use a barter system, so on and so forth. Okay. Everybody that's listening, we really appreciate you. We'll see you next week. We're always going to be committed to making this happen. Like I said, I'm east of Austin right now in a Renaissance festival in the middle of an RV of a close friend, and I am rocking it no matter what. So we will see you next week, and we'll have Frank Bacon on. We're going to talk about that. We might even take a couple calls. I'll let you know at the start of the show. Really appreciate you, Corey. Thank you so much. Thank you, listeners.
Thanks.
And we'll see you next
week.
Thanks,
Jordan.